agency. Alarmed, Ben-Gurion flew to New York to meet with Kennedy at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The Israeli leader was very worried about what he saw as relentless American pressures, but Kennedy was firm. There had to be an inspection. Political efforts were made, but Kennedy was resolute, and Israel was forced to accept an inspection. A bogus control center was built over the real one at Dimona, complete with fake control panels and computer-lined gauges, which gave a credible impression of measuring the output of a reactor engaged in an irrigation scheme to turn the Negev into plush pasture land. The area containing the heavy water, smuggled from France and Norway, was placed off-limits to the inspectors for safety reasons. The sheer volume of heavy water would have been proof the reactor was being readied for a very different purpose. When the Americans arrived, the Israelis were relieved to discover not one spoke Hebrew. It further lessened any possibility of the inspectors uncovering the true intention of Dimona. The stage was set for Rafi Eitan. Gaining access to the NUMEC plant was relatively easy. Israel's embassy in Washington requested permission from the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission for a team of our scientists to visit the facility to better understand the concerns expressed by your inspectors on the reprocessing of nuclear waste. The request was granted, even though the FBI was now running a full-scale surveillance operation to discover whether Shapiro had been recruited as an Israeli spy. Rafi Eitan and his team's stay in Apollo was low-key. Rafi Eitan and his spies left Apollo as quietly as they had come. What followed can only be deduced from FBI reports, and even they leave tantalizing questions as to how much Salman Shapiro may have suspected was behind Rafi Eitan's visit. An FBI report stated that a month after the Israelis had returned home, NUMEC became a partner with the Israeli government in a business involving what was described as the pasteurization of food and the sterilization of medical samples by irradiation. The FBI noted that the NUMEC containers arrived at dusk and left before dawn. All were sheathed with lead, needed to transport enriched uranium, and each container was stamped with a pre-addressed stencil in Hebrew, giving Haifa as the final destination. The FBI could only assume that sufficient quantities of fissionable material had by then reached Dimona. During the agency's subsequent interviews, Shapiro denied he had supplied Israel with nuclear bomb-making material. The FBI said their check of company records showed there was a discrepancy in the amount of material reprocessed. Shapiro insisted the most logical explanation for any lost uranium was that it had seeped into the ground or had been disposed of into the air. All told, the missing material amounted to 100 pounds. Shapiro was never charged with any crime. On a warm afternoon in mid-October 1995, Mossad technicians used a hand-operated scanner to check an apartment off Pinsker Street in downtown Tel Aviv for bugging devices. The apartment was one of several safe houses Mossad owned around the city. The search was an indication of the sensitivity of the meeting shortly to take place there. Satisfied the apartment was electronically clean, they left. The apartment's furniture could have come from a garage sale. Nothing seemed to match. In the kitchen, instead of domestic appliances, were a computer and modem, a shredder, a fax, and where an oven would be, a safe. Usually the safe houses were dormitories for trainees from the Mossad School for Spies on the outskirts of the city while they learned streetcraft. How to tail someone or themselves avoid surveillance, how to set up a dead letter box, or exchange information concealed inside a newspaper. Day and night, the streets of Tel Aviv were their proving ground under the watchful eye of instructors. Back in the safe houses, the lessons continued. How to brief a katza going to a target country, how to write special ink letters or use a computer to create information capable of being transmitted in very short bursts on specified frequencies. Those who could not live by the Kidon credo found themselves swiftly dismissed from the service. In the words of David Kimche, regarded as one of Mossad's best operatives, it's the old story of many think they are called, few are chosen. In that way, we are a little like the Catholic Church. Those who remain develop bonds which will carry them through life. We live by the rule If I help you, you help me. You learn to trust people with your life. No greater trust can ever be given by one person to another. By the time every man or woman who had access to the safe houses graduated to the next group, that philosophy had been engraved on their minds. They were now katzas departing on a mission or returning to be debriefed. Many agents had received their first instructions in a safe house like the one which had been meticulously checked for bugs on that October afternoon. Later in the day, a handful of senior members of Israel's intelligence community would meet around the apartment's dining room table to sanction an assassination that would have the full approval of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In the 3 years he had been in that office, Rabin had attended a growing number of funerals for the victims of terrorist attacks. Rabin had himself, on more than one occasion, participated in an act of revenge. Most notable had been the assassination of Yasser Arafat's deputy, Khalil al-Wazir, known throughout the Arab world and on Mossad's Honeywell computer as Abu Jihad, the voice of holy war, who lived in Tunisia. In 1988, Rabin had been Israel's defense minister when the decision was taken in the same apartment off Pinsker Street. Abu Jihad must die. For 2 months, Mossad agents conducted an exhaustive reconnaissance of Abu Jihad's villa in the resort of Sidi Bou Said on the outskirts of Tunis. Access roads, points of entry, fence heights and types, windows, doors, locks, defenses, the routing employed by Abu Jihad's guards, everything was monitored, checked, and checked again. They watched Abu Jihad's wife play with her children. They came alongside her as she shopped and went to the hairdresser. They listened to her husband's phone calls, bugged their bedroom, listened to their lovemaking. They calculated distances from one room to another, found out what the neighbors did when they were at home, and logged the makes, colors, and registrations of all the vehicles that came and went from the villa. The rule for preparing an assassination Meir Amit had laid down all those years ago was constantly in their minds. Think like your target, and only stop being him when you pull the trigger. Satisfied, the team returned to Tel Aviv. For the next month, they practiced their deadly mission in and around the Mossad safe house near Haifa, which matched the target villa. From the time they would enter Abu Jihad's house, it should take the unit just 22 seconds to murder him. On April 16, 1988, the order was given for the operation to go ahead. That night, several Israeli Air Force Boeing 707s took off from a military base south of Tel Aviv. One carried Yitzhak Rabin and other high-ranking Israeli officers. Their aircraft was in constant touch by safe radio with the execution team already in position and led by an operative codenamed Sword. Two more 707s acted as fuel tankers. High above the villa, the fleet of aircraft circled. A little after midnight on April 17th, the airborne officers heard Abu Jihad had returned home in the Mercedes Yasser Arafat had given him as a wedding gift. Prior to that, the hit team had set up sensitive listening devices able to hear everything inside the villa. From his vantage point near the villa, Sword announced into his mic that he could hear Abu Jihad climbing the stairs going to his bedroom, whispering to his wife, tiptoeing to an adjoining bedroom to kiss his sleeping son, before finally going to his study on the ground floor. The details were picked up by the electronic warfare plane, the Israeli version of an American AWACS, and relayed to Rabin's command aircraft. At 12:17 a.m., Rabin ordered, "Go." Outside the villa, Abu Jihad's driver was asleep in the Mercedes. One of Sword's men ran forward, pressed the silenced Beretta into his ear, and pulled the trigger. The driver slumped dead across the front seat. Next, Sword and another member of the hit team laid an explosive charge at the base of the villa's heavy iron front door. A new type of silent plastic explosive, it made little sound as it blew the doors clean off their hinges. Inside, two of Abu Jihad's bodyguards were standing in the entrance hall, too stunned by the explosion to move. They too were shot dead by silenced weapons. Running to the study, Sword found Abu Jihad watching video footage of the PLO. As he rose to his feet, Sword shot him twice in the chest. Abu Jihad crashed heavily to the floor. Sword stepped quickly forward and put two more bullets through his forehead. Leaving the room, he encountered Abu Jihad's wife. She was holding her small son in her arms. "Get back to your room," Sword ordered in Arabic. Then he and the team vanished into the night. From the time they had entered the villa to departure had taken them only 13 seconds, 9 vital seconds better than their best practice run. For the first time, an Israeli assassination met with public criticism. Cabinet Minister Ezra Weitzman warned that liquidating individuals will not advance the peace process. Nevertheless, the assassinations continued. On an October evening in 1995, in the safe house of Pinsker Street, all was ready for the meeting to settle another assassination. Selected for execution was the religious head of Islamic Jihad, Fatih Shkaki. Mossad had established that his group had orchestrated the deaths of over 20 Israeli passengers in a bus destroyed the previous January by 2 suicide bombers outside the small town of Beit Lid. The incident brought the number of terrorist attacks to over 10,000 in the last quarter century. In this pitiless world, Shkaki had long been lionized by his people. It was he who had personally granted the bombers of Beit Lid absolution from the inviolable Islamic prohibition against suicide. To do so, he had combed the Quran to extrapolate a philosophical assumption that oppression makes the oppressed discover new strengths. In preparing the suicide bombers, he had exploited the psychological flaws in unbalanced youngsters who, like the Japanese kamikaze teenagers in World War II, went to their own end in a state of religious fervor. His next recruits chosen, their target selected, Shkaki would hand the youths over to his bomb makers. On an October evening, when his fate was about to be settled in the Tel Aviv safe house, Shkaki was at home in Damascus with his wife, Fatia. The apartment was strikingly different from the squalor of the refugee camps where he was venerated. Expensive carpets and wall hangings were gifts from the Ayatollahs of Iran. A gold-framed photograph of Shkaki with Muammar Gaddafi was a present from the Libyan leader. A coffee service was a gift from the Syrian president. Shkaki's clothes were far removed from the simple gown he wore on his crusades among the impoverished masses in South Lebanon. At home, he wore robes cut from the finest cloth available from London's Savile Row, and his feet were fitted in custom-made shoes bought in Rome, not the bizarre sandals he wore in public. Over his favorite meal of couscous, Shkaki reassured his wife he would be safe on his forthcoming trip to Libya to seek further funds from Gaddafi. He hoped to return with $1 million, the full amount he had requested in a fax to Libya's revolutionary headquarters in Tripoli. As usual, the money would be laundered through a Libyan bank in Valletta on the island of Malta. Shkaki planned to spend less than a day on the island before catching the flight home. News of the stopover in Malta had prompted his two teenage sons to give him their own shopping order. Half a dozen shirts each from a Malta store where Shkaki had shopped previously. Rabin, who was now a Nobel Peace Prize winner, ordered Shkaki's execution. Details of Shkaki's forthcoming visit to Libya and Malta were sent to Tel Aviv. On October 24, 1995, two men in their late 20s, codenamed Gil and Ran, left Tel Aviv on separate flights. Ran flew to Athens, Gil to Rome. At each airport, they collected new British passports handed over by a local Sayan. They arrived in Malta on a late afternoon flight and checked into the Diplomat Hotel, overlooking Valletta's harbor. That evening, a motorcycle was delivered to Ran. He told staff he planned to use it to tour the island. That evening, a freighter, which had sailed the previous day from the port of Haifa, bound for Italy, radioed the Maltese harbor authorities, reporting it had developed engine trouble, and while it was being fixed, the ship would remain hove to off the island. On board the freighter were Shabtai Shavit and a small team of Mossad communication technicians. They established a radio link with Gil, whose suitcase contained a small but powerful radio. The suitcase's locks had to be opened counterclockwise to deactivate the fuses in the two charges built into the lid. They were designed to explode in the face of anyone who opened the case after turning the keys clockwise. The radio's rhombic antenna, a quarter of a mile of fiber-optic cable, was tightly coiled to form a disc 6 inches in diameter. Splitters connected the disc to 4 dipoles welded to the inside corner of the Samsonite. During the night, Gil received a number of radio messages from the boat. Fatishkaki had arrived earlier that day on the Tripoli Valletta ferry, accompanied by Libyan security men who had stayed on board, their responsibilities over when Shkaki came ashore alone. Before doing so, he had shaved off his beard. He identified himself to Maltese immigration officers as Ibrahim Dawish, showing them his Libyan passport. After checking into the diplomat hotel, he spent the next few hours in seafront cafes, sipping endless cups of coffee and nibbling sweet Arabic cakes. He made several telephone calls. The next morning, Shkaki was returning with the promised shirts for his sons, strolling along the seafront, when two men on a motorcycle slowed beside him. One of them shot the jihad leader at point-blank range 6 times in the head. Shkaki died instantly. The motorcyclists disappeared. Neither was ever found. But an hour later, a fishing boat sailed out of Valletta Harbor and dropped anchor in the lee of the freighter. Shortly afterward, the captain informed the harbor authorities that the engine malfunction had been temporarily repaired, but the ship was returning to Haifa for further repairs. In Iran, the spiritual home of Shkaki, the mullahs declared a day of national mourning. In Tel Aviv, asked to comment on the death, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said, "I'm certainly not sad." A few days later, on November 4, 1995, Rabin was assassinated at a Tel Aviv peace rally close to the safe house where his order to execute Shkaki had been prepared. Rabin had died at the hands of a Jewish fanatic, Yigal Amir, who in many ways had the same ruthless qualities the Prime Minister had so admired in Mossad. Yitzhak Rabin, the hawk who had become a dove, the powerful political leader who had come to realize the only chance of peace in the Middle East was, as he once misquoted his favorite book, The Bible, is to turn our swords into plowshares and till the soil with our Arab neighbors. He was murdered by one of his own people because he failed to accept that his Jewish enemies would behave with the same ferocity as his old Arab foes had done, both groups determined to destroy his vision of the future. In 1998, there were 48 members in the Mossad Kidon unit, 6 of them women. All were in their 20s and superbly fit. They lived and worked away from Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv, based in a restricted area of a military base in the Negev Desert. The facility could be adapted to approximate a street or a building where an assassination was to take place. There were getaway cars and an obstacle course to negotiate. The instructors included former unit members who supervised practice with a variety of guns and taught how to conceal bombs, administer a lethal injection in a crowd, and make a killing appear accidental. Kidons reviewed films on successful assassinations, the shooting of President John F. Kennedy, for example, and studied the faces and habits of scores of potential targets stored on their own highly restricted computer, and memorized the constantly changing street plans of major cities, as well as air and seaport layouts. The unit worked in teams of 4, who regularly flew abroad on familiarization trips to London, Paris, Frankfurt, and other European cities. There were also occasional trips to New York, Los Angeles, and Toronto. During all of these outings, a team was always accompanied by instructors who assessed their skills in setting up an operation without drawing attention to themselves. Targets were chosen from local Sayanim volunteers who were only told they were taking part in a security exercise designed to protect an Israeli-owned facility. A synagogue or bank were usually given as the reason. Volunteers found themselves pounced upon in a quiet street and bundled into a car, or had their homes entered in the middle of the night and awoke to find themselves peering down a gun barrel. Kidons took these training exercises very seriously, for every team was aware of what was known as the Lillehammer fiasco. In July 1973, at the height of the manhunt for the killers of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics, a makeshift Mossad team shot dead a Moroccan waiter named Ahmed Bouchiki, who had no connection to terrorism. The entire Mossad undercover network in Europe of safe houses, dead letter boxes, and secret phone numbers had to be abandoned. It would be 6 years before Ali Hassan Salameh would finally die in the operation masterminded by Rafi Eitan, who said Lillehammer was an example of the wrong people for the wrong job. It should never have happened and must never happen again. It did. On July 31, 1997, the day after two Hamas suicide bombers killed 15 and injured another 157 people in a Jerusalem marketplace, Mossad chief Dani Yatom attended a meeting chaired by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Prime Minister had just come from an emotional press conference at which he had promised that he would never rest until those who planned the suicide bombings were no longer a threat. Publicly, Netanyahu had appeared calm and resolute, his responses to questions measured and magisterial. But on that stifling day, away from the cameras and surrounded only by Mossad director Yatom and other senior intelligence officers, Netanyahu offered a very different image. He was neither cool nor analytical. Instead, in the crowded conference room adjoining his office, he frequently interrupted to shout he was going to get those Hamas bastards if it's the last thing I do. The agenda had been set. Yatom, well used to the mercurial mood swings of the Prime Minister, sat silently across the table as Netanyahu continued to bluster. Netanyahu badly needed a public relations coup. To deliver the head of a Hamas leader was one surefire way. A senior Israeli intelligence officer undoubtedly spoke for many when he said, "Any operation of that nature requires careful planning. Bibi wanted results as if this was a computer game." By September 1997, Netanyahu had begun to call Yatom at all hours of the night about progress. But on September 9th, news reached Tel Aviv that Hamas had struck again, this time seriously wounding two Israeli bodyguards of the cultural attaché at the newly opened Israeli embassy in Amman, the Jordanian capital. 3 days later, shortly before the Friday Sabbath began, Netanyahu requested that Yatom join him for lunch. The Prime Minister immediately raised the attack in Amman. How could the Hamas gunmen have come close enough to shoot? Why had there been no advance warning? What was the Mossad station in Amman doing about it? Yatom interrupted Netanyahu in mid-flow. There was a Hamas leader in Amman named Khalid Meshal, who ran the organization's Politburo from an office in the city. For weeks, Meshal had been traveling through various Arab countries, but Amman station reported that he was back in the city. Netanyahu was galvanized. "Then go and knock him down," he said across the table. "That's what you have to do, knock him down. Send your people in Amman to do that." The Mossad chief warned that to launch an attack in Amman would destroy the relationship with Jordan that Netanyahu's predecessor, Yitzhak Rabin, had created. "Excuses, that's all you give me, excuses," Netanyahu was said to have shouted. From that moment on, every move that Yatom made would be personally approved by Netanyahu. No other prime minister had taken such a close personal interest in a state-sponsored act of murder. Khalid Meshal was 41 years old, a full-bearded and physically strong man. He lived close to King Hussein's palace and by all accounts was a devoted husband and father of 7 children, cultured and well-spoken. Yet the rapidly assembled data that Mossad's Amman station had put together indicated Meshal was the driving force behind the suicide bomb attacks against Israeli civilians. Mossad's weapon of choice was unusual, not a gun, but an aerosol filled with a nerve agent. It would be the first time a Kidon hit team had used this method of killing. Even though it had long been perfected by the KGB and other Soviet bloc intelligence agencies, Russian scientists recently emigrated to Israel had been recruited by Mossad to create a range of deadly toxins, all outlawed under international treaties. The substances were intended to produce death that could be instantaneous or lingering. In all cases, the victim lost control over his internal organs and suffered pain so excruciating that death itself would be a merciful release. On September 24, 1997, the Kidon unit assigned to assassinate Meshal flew into Amman, Jordan. The hitmen had been given Canadian passports in the names of Barry Beads and Sean Kendall. At 10 a.m., Michel was being driven by his chauffeur to work. In the back of the car with him were three of his young children, a boy and two girls. Barry Beads followed at a discreet distance in a rented car. Other team members were out on the road in other cars. As they entered the city's Garden District, the chauffeur informed Michel that they were being followed. Michel used the car phone to call in the make and number of Beads' car to Amman Police Headquarters. As the rented car drove past, Michel's children waved at Beads, as they had done to other motorists. The Mossad agent ignored them. Next, Kendall's rented green Hyundai pulled ahead of the chauffeur, and both cars disappeared into the traffic. The chauffeur pulled into Wasfi Altal Street, where a crowd had gathered outside the Hamas office. Michel quickly kissed his children before leaving the car. Beads stepped forward as if to shake him by the hand. Kendall was at his shoulder, fumbling with a plastic bag. "Mr. Michel?" asked Beads pleasantly. Michel looked at him uncertainly. At that moment, Kendall produced the aerosol and tried to spray its contents into Michel's left ear. The Hamas leader recoiled, startled, wiping his lobe. Kendall made another attempt to spray the substance into Michel's ear. Around him, the crowd were beginning to recover from their surprise, and hands reached out to grab the agents. "Run," said Beads in Hebrew. Followed by Kendall, Beads sprinted to his car, parked a little way up the street. Michel's chauffeur had seen what was happening and began to reverse back down the street, trying to ram the rented Toyota. Michel was staggering around, moaning. People were trying to support him from falling. Others were shouting for an ambulance. Beads, with Kendall sprawled beside him and still clutching his half-used aerosol, managed to avoid the chauffeur's car and was accelerating up the street. Others were in pursuit. One of the drivers had a cell phone and called for roads to be blocked. The chauffeur used his car phone to contact police. Beads and Kendall were caught and forced to lie on the ground. They were taken to Amman Central Police Headquarters, where they produced their Canadian passports and insisted they were victims of some horrendous plot. The arrival of Sami Batihi, the formidable chief of Jordanian counterintelligence, ended the pretense. He told them he knew who they were. News of the failure reached Israel swiftly. Netanyahu received a telephone call from King Hussein on the hotline installed between the two leaders to deal with the crisis. The flavor of the call came later from an Israeli intelligence officer. Hussein had two questions for Bibi. What the fuck did he think he had been playing at? Did he have an antidote for the nerve gas? Netanyahu sat there, hunched over his phone, as white as anyone caught with his hand in the till. Netanyahu offered to fly at once to Amman to explain matters to the king. Hussein told him not to waste his time. The intelligence officer recalled, "You could hear the ice crackling on the line from Jordan. It must have been the worst moment in Bibi's political life." Events now took on their own momentum. Within an hour, an antidote to the nerve gas had been flown to Amman by an Israeli military plane and administered to Michel. He began to recover. Kendall and Beads were allowed back to Israel, minus their Canadian passports. They were assigned to non-specific desk duties. As an Israeli intelligence officer said, that could mean they would be in charge of security in the building's toilets. Yatom had become a lame duck chief. In February 1998, Yatom resigned in an attempt to head off what he acknowledged was a near mutiny. Prime Minister Netanyahu did not send his fallen intelligence chief the customary letter of thanks for services rendered. On a damp spring morning in 1997, David Kimche instructed Arab landscapers how he wanted his garden rearranged in a Tel Aviv suburb. His manner was diffident, the mellifluous voice more suited to a college campus than dealing with manual workers, suggesting Kimche was descended from generations of administrators who had once raised Britain's Union Jack over far-flung lands. The English-born son of middle-class Jews, Kimche's impeccable manners deepened the image of the quintessential Englishman. Expensively tailored clothes emphasized a figure kept trim with regular workouts and a strict diet. Kimche looked 20 years younger than his close to 60 years, and there was a boyish quality about him. His every gesture while briefing the gardeners, the flicking away of hair from his forehead, the lengthy pauses, the thoughtful stare, suggested a lifetime spent cloistered on a college campus. In reality, David Kimche had been what Mossad director Meir Amit called one of the intellectual powerhouses behind many Mossad operations. His reasoning skills had been accompanied by breathtaking nerve, catching even the wariest with some totally unexpected move which had quickly earned the respect of even cynical colleagues. But his very intellectualism had often made them keep their distance. He was too remote and abstract for their earthy ways. Several felt like Rafi Eitan, that if you said good morning to David, his mind would already be deciding how good it was and how much of the morning was left. Within Mossad, Kimche was widely regarded as the epitome of the gentleman spy with the cunning of an alley cat. How, where, and by whom Kimche was recruited was something he would forever keep under lock and key. David Kimche sensed he had arrived at an eventful time. Mossad director Meir Amit was about to leave, shortly to be followed by Rafi Eitan and other senior Mossad officers. Part of Kimche's work included monitoring events in Morocco. There were still a substantial number of Jews living there under the repressive regime of King Hassan. In an attempt to make their lives easier, Meir Amit had established a working relationship with the monarch's feared security service, finding common cause in trying to remove Egypt's President Nasser, whose own hatred of Israel was only equaled by what he felt for the king. Kimche had many matters to concern him. The Palestinians had secretly trained a commando unit to exploit a security weakness not even Mossad had anticipated: mid-air aircraft hijacking. Once a plane was seized between destinations, it would be flown to a friendly Arab country. There the passengers would be held for ransom, either for substantial sums of money to buy their freedom or to be exchanged for Arab prisoners held by Israel. An additional bonus would be the worldwide publicity for the PLO cause. In July 1968, an El Al flight from Rome was hijacked to Algeria. Mossad was stunned at the simple audacity of the operation. A team of Katzas flew to Algeria while Kimche and other planners worked almost around the clock to devise a strategy to free the terrified passengers. But any attempt to storm the aircraft was hampered by the presence of the world's media crews covering the story. Kimche recommended playing for time in the hope the story would lose its momentum and the Katzas could move. But the hijackers had anticipated that and began to issue blood-curdling threats unless their demands were met: the freeing of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The Algerian government supported the hijackers. Kimche realized we were between the proverbial rock and the hard place. He was one of those who reluctantly recommended the prisoners should be exchanged for passengers, knowing full well the consequences of such action. It would pave the way for further hijackings. It would ensure the PLO cause would receive from now on maximum coverage. Israel had been put on the defensive. So had Western governments, who also had no answer to hijackings. Yet what could we do except to wait grimly for the next hijacking? And come they did, each one better prepared than the last. In a short time, half a dozen more passenger aircraft were overpowered by hijackers, who were not only expert in concealing weapons and placing explosives on board, but had been trained to fly the actual aircraft, or know the actual workings of a flight deck crew. In the Libyan desert, they practiced exchanging fire in the confined area of an airplane cabin, knowing that El Al had now introduced armed guards on its flights, one of the first moves Kimche had recommended. He had also correctly predicted that the hijackers would know the laws of the various countries they would be flying in and out of, so that if they were captured, their colleagues could use those laws to obtain their freedom by bargaining or threatening. Kimche knew that Mossad urgently needed an incident which would enable the service to overcome the hijackers through the two skills for which it was justifiably renowned: cunning and ruthlessness. And just as the hijackers effectively used publicity, Kimche wanted an operation whose outcome would match the universal praise for Israel which had followed the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann. The incident Kimche needed must have high drama, considerable risk, and an against-all-the-odds outcome. Those elements would combine to show Mossad leading the fight back. On June 27, 1976, an Air France plane filled with Jewish passengers en route to Paris from Tel Aviv was hijacked after a stopover at Athens Airport, which was notorious for lax security. The hijackers were members of the extreme Wadi Hadad faction, and they made two demands: the freeing of 40 Palestinians in Israeli jails, together with a further dozen held in European prisons, and the release of two German terrorists arrested in Kenya when they tried to shoot down an El Al jet with a SAM-7 rocket as it took off from Nairobi Airport. After a stopover in Casablanca and being refused permission to land in Khartoum, the plane flew to Entebbe in Uganda. From there, the hijackers announced the aircraft would be blown up along with all its passengers unless their demands were met. The deadline was June 30th. In Tel Aviv, in closed cabinet sessions, the vaunted public image of no surrender to terrorism wilted. Ministers favored freeing Israel's PLO prisoners. Prime Minister Rabin produced a Shin Bet report to show there was a precedent for releasing convicted criminals. Chief of Staff Mordechai Gur announced he could not recommend military action due to insufficient intelligence from Entebbe. While their anguished deliberations continued, news came from Entebbe that the Jewish passengers had been separated from the others on board. Those passengers had been released and were on their way to Paris. That had been the opening Mossad needed. Yitzhak Hofi, Mossad's chief, in what was to be his finest hour, argued powerfully and passionately for a rescue to be mounted. He dusted down the plan Rafi Eitan had used to capture Eichmann. There were similarities. Rafi Eitan and his men had worked far from home in a hostile environment. They had improvised as they went along, using bluff, the renowned Jewish chutzpah. It could be done again. Soaked in sweat, his voice hoarse from pleading and arguing, Hofi had stared around the cabinet room. If we let our people die, it will open the floodgates. No Jew will be safe anywhere. Hitler would have won a victory from the grave. Very well, Rabin finally said. We try. As well as Kimche, every other strategist and planner in Mossad was mobilized. The first step was to open a safe communication channel between Tel Aviv and Nairobi. Hofi had nursed the unpublicized intelligence link between Mossad and its Kenyan counterpart introduced by Mayor Amit. The link started to bear immediate results. Half a dozen katzas descended on Nairobi and were installed in a Kenyan intelligence service safe house. They would form the bridgehead for the main assault. Meantime, Kimche had overcome another problem. Any rescue mission would require a fuel stop at Nairobi. Working the phone, he obtained Kenya's approval in a matter of hours, granted on humanitarian grounds. But there was still the formidable problem of reaching Entebbe. The PLO had established the airport as their own entry point to Uganda, from where the organization ran its own operation against the pro-Israeli white supremacist regime in South Africa. Idi Amin, Uganda's despotic dictator, had actually given the PLO the residence of the Israeli ambassador as a headquarters after breaking off diplomatic relations with Jerusalem in 1972. Kimche knew it was essential to know if the PLO were still in the country. Their battle-hardened guerrillas would be a formidable force to overcome in the short time allowed for the actual rescue mission. The Israeli forces could only be on the ground for minutes, otherwise they ran the risk of a powerful counterattack. Kimche sent two katzas from Nairobi by boat across Lake Victoria. They landed near Entebbe and found the PLO headquarters deserted. The Palestinians had recently moved on to Angola. Then, with a stroke of luck any operation needs, one of the Kenyan security officers who had accompanied the katzas discovered that one of his wife's relatives was actually one of the men guarding the hostages. The Kenyan inveigled himself into the airport and was able to see that the hostages were all alive, but he counted 15 very tense and nervous guards. The information was radioed to Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, two other katzas, both qualified pilots, hired a Cessna and flew from Nairobi, ostensibly to photograph Lake Victoria for a holiday brochure. Their aircraft passed directly over Entebbe Airport enabling one Katza to obtain good photographs of the runway and adjoining buildings. The film was flown to Tel Aviv. There, Kimche recommended yet another strategy to confuse the hijackers. During several telephone conversations with Amin's palace, Israeli negotiators in Tel Aviv made it clear their government was ready to accept the hijackers' terms. A diplomat in a European consulate in Uganda was used to add credibility to this apparent surrender by being called in confidence to see if he could negotiate suitable wording the hijackers would accept. Kimche told the envoy, "It must be something not too demeaning to Israel, but also not too impossible for the hijackers to accept." The diplomat hurried to the airport with the news and began to draft suitable words. He was still doing so as Operation Thunderball moved to the final stages. An unmarked Israeli Boeing 707, to be used as a flying hospital, landed at Nairobi Airport, flown by IDF pilots who knew Entebbe Airport. Meantime, six Mossad Katzas had surrounded that airport. Each man carried a high-frequency radio and an electronic device which would jam the radar in the control tower. It had never before been tried under combat conditions. 50 Israeli paratroopers, under cover of darkness, left the hospital plane and went full speed to Lake Victoria. Inflating their rubber boats, they rowed across the water to wait close to the Ugandan shore, ready to storm into Entebbe Airport. In Tel Aviv, the rescue mission had been rehearsed to perfection. When the time came, a force of C-130 Hercules transporters crossed the Red Sea, headed south, refueled at Nairobi, and then flying just above the African treetops, swept down on Entebbe Airport. The radar jammer worked perfectly. The airport authorities were still trying to work out what had happened when the three Hercules transporters and the hospital plane landed. Commandos raced into the building where the hostages were held. By then, they were only Jews. All other nationalities had been freed by Amin, enjoying his moment of strutting the world stage. The paratroopers waiting in support were never called into action. They rowed back across the lake and returned to Nairobi. There they would be picked up by another Israeli transporter and flown home. Within 5 minutes, 2 full minutes less than the time allowed, the hostages were free, and all the terrorists were killed, along with 16 Ugandan soldiers guarding the prisoners. The attack force lost one officer, Lieutenant Colonel Yonatan Netanyahu, the elder brother of the future Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He would say that his own hard line against all terrorists came as a result of the death of Yonatan. 3 hostages also died. David Kimche's wish for a headline-making riposte to hijackers had been more than met. The rescue at Entebbe was an episode that even more than the capture of Adolf Eichmann came to be seen as Mossad's calling card. Increasingly, Kimche found himself ever more immersed in Mossad's efforts against the PLO. This deadly struggle was fought beyond the borders of Israel, on the streets of European cities. Kimche was one of the strategists who prepared the ground for Mossad's own assassins, the Kidons. They struck in Paris, Munich, Cyprus, and Athens. For Kimche, the killings were remote. He was like the bomber pilot who does not see where the bombs fall. By 1973, another and more serious threat had begun to focus Kimche's mind: the possibility of a second full-scale Arab war led by Egypt against Israel. But Mossad was a lone voice within the Israeli intelligence community. Kimche remained unconvinced. On the night of October 5th to 6th, Mossad received reports that the Egyptian military high command had gone on red alert. The evidence could no longer be ignored. At 6 a.m., Mossad's chief, Tzvi Zamir, joined Amman intelligence chiefs in the defense ministry. The building was almost deserted. It was Yom Kippur, the holiest of all Jewish holidays, the day even non-practicing Jews rested, when all public services, including the state radio, shut down. The radio had always been the means used to mobilize reserves in the event of a national emergency. Alarm bells began to sound all over Israel that a two-pronged attack from Syria in the north and Egypt in the south was about to engulf Israel. War began at 1:55 p.m. local time, while the Israeli cabinet was in emergency session, assured by Amman strategists that hostilities would still only start at 6 p.m. Never in the history of the Israeli intelligence community had there been such an inglorious failure to predict an event. The mass of impeccable evidence that David Kimchi and others had provided had been totally ignored. After the war ended, Mossad once more ruled supreme over the intelligence community, though there was a key change there too. Zamir was removed as director general of the Mossad on the grounds he had not been sufficiently assertive. His place was taken by Yitzhak Hofi. Kimche viewed Hofi's arrival with mixed feelings. In some ways, Hofi was from a similar mold to Meir Amit, the same erect bearing, the same proven battlefield experience, the same incisive manner and total inability to suffer fools at any price. But Hofi was also blunt to the point of rudeness. Kimche saw an opportunity for Mossad to work its way into the Lebanese woodwork. He told Mossad director Hofi that politically it made sense to partly support the Christians against the Muslims who were vowed to destroy Israel. But the service's relationship with the Christians soured in January 1976 when Christian leaders invited in the Syrian army to lend additional support against the pro-Iranian Hezbollah. That group was seen in Damascus as a threat. Within days, thousands of battle-hardened Syrian troops were in Lebanon and moving close to its borders with Israel. Too late, the Christians found they had, in Kimche's words, behaved like Little Red Riding Hood inviting in the wolf. Kimche launched his own guerrilla battle against Israel's Bet Noir, the PLO. It was a halcyon time for the men operating out of the featureless high-rise on King Saul Boulevard. Inside the building, relations between Kimche and Hofi were deteriorating. There were whispers of violent disagreements over operational matters that Hofi feared Kimche wanted his job. On a spring morning in 1980, David Kimche used his unrestricted access card, which had replaced the two keys, to access the headquarters building. Arriving in his office, he was told that Hofi wished to see him at once. Kimche strolled along the corridor to the director general's office, knocked and entered, closing the door behind him. What happened there has passed into Mossad legend, a tale of increasingly raised voices of accusation and counter-accusation. The row lasted for 20 electrifying minutes. Then Kimche came out of the office tight-lipped. His career in Mossad was finished. But Kimche's intelligence activities on behalf of Israel were about to enter a familiar arena, the United States. This time it would not involve the theft of nuclear materials, but the scandal that eventually became known as Irangate. After a period of considering his future, David Kimche had accepted the director generalship of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. It offered him an opportunity to bring his skills to bear on the international stage far beyond Lebanon. Meanwhile, in the United States, the saga of President Nixon and Watergate had moved to an inescapable finale, leaving the CIA tarred with suspicion. Kimche studied it closely. But there was a new president in the White House, Ronald Reagan, who promised a new dawn for the CIA. The agency, Kimche learned from his own contacts in Washington, would become Reagan's secret trump in foreign policy. Heading the CIA was William Casey. Instinctively, Kimche sensed he was no friend of Israel, but someone who could be outmaneuvered should the need arise. For the next 2 years, as part of his work, Kimche closely followed CIA operations in Afghanistan and Central America. Many of them struck him as babe-in-the-wood stuff, old-fashioned intelligence gathering, mingled with some pretty ruthless killing. Then once more, Kimche's attention was brought to focus on Iran and what had happened in Beirut. A few months after Kimche took up his duties at the Foreign Ministry, Israel had begun to arm Iran with the tacit support of the United States. Israel had provided the help to weaken the Baghdad regime, part of Jerusalem's long-established tactic of what Kimche called playing at both ends. 3 years later, two events had affected matters. There had been the car bomb massacre in Beirut of 241 U.S. Marines, and the growing U.S. suspicion that Mossad not only had prior knowledge of the attack, but that Iran's intelligence service had helped to prepare it. Pressure was put on Israel to stop supplying Tehran. It increased with the kidnapping, torture, and subsequent death of William Buckley, the CIA station chief in Beirut. In quick succession, seven other Americans were taken hostage by Iran-backed groups. For the tough-talking Reagan administration, which had come into office with its promise to crack down on terrorism, the idea of American citizens languishing deep beneath the rubble of Beirut demanded action. But retaliation was out of the question. There then occurred a conversation between the President and Robert McFarlane, a gung-ho former Marine who was National Security Advisor. Kimche was to recall that McFarlane told him the conversation went like this. What do the Iranians need most, Mr. President? You tell me, Bob. Weapons to fight Iraq. So we give them what they want, and we get back our people in return. Reagan and McFarlane, against the advice of Casey and other U.S. intelligence chiefs, took the simplistic view that arming Iran would not only result in the mullahs bringing pressure to bear on the Beirut group to free the hostages, but would improve the administration's relations with Tehran. There could also be the added bonus that it was bound to weaken Moscow's position in Iran. The seeds were sown for what became known as Iran Gate. Marine Colonel Oliver North was put in charge of supplying the arms. North and McFarlane decided to exclude the CIA from their plans. Both were action-oriented men. Their push-and-shove mentality had served them well in Vietnam, and from all they had heard, Israelis were similar men of action. So, in North's words, it was time to bring Israel into the fold. There was also the personal prospect of visiting the Holy Land. A committed Christian, North relished the thought of treading in the footsteps of Jesus. Israel's new Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir decided there was only one person capable of handling the request from Washington for help and making sure Israel's interests were fully protected. On July 3, 1983, David Kimche flew to meet with McFarlane in the White House. Kimche said he believed the arms for hostages deal could work. He asked if the CIA was actively involved. He was told the agency was not. In turn, McFarlane asked Kimche how far Mossad would be involved. Kimche claims that McFarlane reassured Reagan that Israel would batten down the hatches. The deal was on. Kimche flew back to Israel. 2 weeks later, Kimche was back in Washington. Over dinner, he laid out his game plan to McFarlane. Kimche was to recall the conversation went like this. You want the good or bad news first? Kimche asked McFarlane. The good. We'll ship the arms for you, using the same routes we used before. McFarlane said, no problem. Kimche's method would ensure that the United States had no direct contact with Iran, and so the administration's bellicose attitude about being tough on terrorism would not be compromised. The U.S. arms embargo on Iran would be intact, and the hostages, when freed, would not have been directly exchanged for weapons. And the bad news? McFarlane prompted. Kimche said his own well-placed contacts in Iran were uncertain the mullahs could actually manage to procure the release of the Beirut hostages. The radicals there are getting beyond Tehran's control, he told his host. If McFarlane was disappointed, he did not show it. The next day, Secretary of State George Shultz told Reagan back in the Oval Office the risks were too high. Supposing the Iranians took the arms and then revealed the deal to embarrass the great Satan, as the mullahs called the United States. Wouldn't that draw Iraq further into the Soviet camp? And what about the hostages? They could be even worse off. All morning the arguments continued. By lunchtime Reagan was visibly tired. The decision, when it came, was sudden. The president agreed to support the proposition that the United States would replace all arms Israel sold to Iran. Once more, Kimche returned home with a green light. Nevertheless, Shamir insisted that all possible steps should also be taken so that he could deny any connection with the matter should there be a problem. To ensure this, Kimche assembled a colorful cast of characters to initiate the operation. There was Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi petrobillionaire with a habit of eating caviar by the pound and an eye for the current cover girls. There was the equally mysterious Yaakov Nimrodi, who had run agents for Amman, who had once been Israel's military attaché in Iran during the Shah's regime. Khashoggi brokered a deal that was to be a precursor for all that followed. He would head a consortium that would indemnify the United States if Iran failed to live up to its obligations, and would similarly protect Iran if the arms were not acceptable as specified. For these guarantees, the consortium would receive a 10% fee from the purchase of all the arms with cash provided by the United States. In return, it would also act as a buffer to ensure that plausible deniability would remain intact for both the Iranian and U.S. governments if anything went wrong. Everyone understood that the consortium would essentially be working outside any political control and would first and foremost be driven by the profit motive. In late August 1985, the first plane load of arms landed in Tehran from Israel. On September 14th, a U.S. hostage, the Reverend Benjamin Weir, was freed in Beirut. As the pace quickened, still more raffish players joined the consortium, including Miles Copeland, a former CIA officer, who on the eve of the Shah falling from power in what was soon to be named the Islamic Republic of Iran, had sent CIA agents into Tehran's souks, distributing $100 bills to anyone who dared shout, "Long live the Shah!" Other shadowy figures also became involved, such as a former Special Air Services officer who ran a company in London which had once provided non-specific services to Mossad. Meanwhile, the policymakers in Israel and Washington looked the other way. All that mattered was that the operation had taken off under the noses of an unsuspecting world, at least for the moment. In all, Iran would receive 128 U.S. tanks, 200,000 Katyusha rockets captured in South Lebanon, 10,000 tons of artillery shells of all calibers, 3,000 air-to-air missiles, 4,000 rifles, and close to 50 million rounds of ammunition. From Marama Air Force Base in Arizona, over 4,000 TOW missiles were lifted to Guatemala to begin their long journey to Tel Aviv. From Poland and Bulgaria, 8,000 SAM-7 surface-to-air missiles were shipped, together with 100,000 AK-47s. China provided hundreds of Silkworm sea-to-sea missiles, armored cars, and amphibious personnel carriers. Sweden provided 105mm artillery shells, Belgium air-to-air missiles. The weapons were shipped with certificates, showing Israel was the end user. From IDF military bases in the Negev Desert, the consortium arranged for chartered transport aircraft to fly the weapons to Iran. The consortium received a handling fee for each consignment, Iran paying the money out of funds in Swiss bank accounts. The sum eventually totaled $7 million. Israel received no financial reward, only the satisfaction of witnessing Iran improve its capability to kill more Iraqis in the long, drawn-out war between both countries. For David Kimche, it was a further example of the divide-and-rule policy he strongly advocated. Nevertheless, his well-honed instincts told him that what had started as a sweet operation was now in danger of running out of control. In his view, the wrong men now had too much power in the consortium. In creating it, he had again demonstrated Israel's realpolitik. Israel had been ready to help the United States because it recognized it could not survive without Washington's support in other areas. It was also a way to demonstrate that Israel could perform decisively on the world stage and keep matters secret. But the longer the arms for hostages operation continued, Kimche sensed the greater was the chance of discovery. In December 1985, he told the consortium that he could no longer remain involved in its activities, using the old saw of being overworked at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The consortium thanked him for his help, gave him a farewell dinner in a Tel Aviv hotel, and told him that he was being replaced as the Israeli link by Amiran Nir, who was Peres' gung-ho advisor on terrorism. That was the moment, Kimche would later admit, when the arms for hostages deal was firmly on the fast track to self-destruction. If anyone could derail it, then Nir was the man. A former journalist, Nir had shown the alarming trait of regarding real-life intelligence as being part of the same world occupied by the James Bond thrillers he so liked. He shared that fatal weakness with men in Mossad who had also decided that journalists could also serve their purpose. The cavernous lobby of the Palestine Meridian Hotel in Baghdad was crowded as usual on that last Friday in April 1988, and the mood was cheerful. Iraq had just won a decisive battle against Iran in the Gulf of Basra, and the consensus was that their war was finally drawing to an end after 7 bloody years. One reason for impending Iraqi victory could be attributed to the foreigners who sat in the lobby in their well-tailored blazers and trousers with uniformly knife-edge creases, the permanent smiles of successful salesmen on their faces. They were arms dealers. Their Iraqi hosts needed no translation. Their hosts spoke an esoteric jargon. Every and any kind of weapon was for sale. All payments would be made in U.S. dollars, still the preferred currency in this closed world. Since the formation of the Jewish state, a formal state of war had existed between Israel and Iraq. Israel had felt confident its forces could win a conventional war. But in 1977, Mossad discovered the French government, which had provided Israel with its own nuclear capability, had also given Iraq a reactor and technical assistance. The facility was Al-Tuwaita, north of Baghdad. The Israeli Air Force began planning how to bomb the site before it became hot with the uranium rods in the reactor core. To destroy it then would cause widespread death and pollution and turn Baghdad and a sizable area of Iraq into an irradiated desert and earn Israel global condemnation. For these reasons, Yitzhak Hofi, then Mossad's chief, opposed the raid, arguing an airstrike would anyway result in a heavy death toll among the French technicians and would isolate European countries Israel was trying to reassure on its peaceful intentions. Bombing the reactor would also effectively end the delicate maneuvering to persuade Egypt to sign a peace treaty. He found himself presiding over